Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addisk, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, April 10th, 2014. Good afternoon, Al.
Hi, Melody.
An exciting day in the markets today.
Yep, interesting.
An interesting day, I should say. It was exciting for gold earlier in the day, but kind of lost a little bit of interest in gold. You had it lose a few dollars from its high on the day, but the stock,
it's still up $6 for the day, or thereabouts.
Still up $6 for the day, and but let's go ahead and get started right away. You have gold up $6 today at $1,319 off the high of $1,325. Silver's up 20 cents at $2,014. Platinum was up 13 at $1,460, along with palladium up 8. At 794. And actually, what's happening in the markets and every way, gold should have been up $50 to $100, but we got six. The USDX today was down again. It's come back from its low on the day, though, 79.40. And this is what they usually do. Usually, the last day of trade or the last hour of trade, things get readjusted. So they are not as severe as they could be. Plunge protection team gets to work on the numbers. Crude oil today was down 17 cents at 103.43. And you had earnings season started, and of course that's what they're blaming on. The biotech sector in the NASDAQ got hit pretty hard today. The NASDAQ slipped 3% today, down 129 points. And that's very unusual to have that big of a drop in the NASDAQ. But down 3.10%. The Dow down almost 300 points at 267 to the downside, 16,169. And the S&P was down 39, a little over 2% at 1833. And it looks like everybody was heading to the Treasuries, the 10-year yield, for a little bit of security. Of course, we saw that in gold also, but the 10-year yield today, 2.63%, down 0.06. So that shows you that a lot of folks went into the 10-year yield for safety. And you did have the people applying for U.S. unemployment benefits today. That did drop to 300,000. Actually, they say that's the lowest level in nearly 7 years, but there was You know, they're already blaming it on a volatility reporting for March and April, and they're going to blame Easter and everything else. So we'll see where that heads us, but an interesting day in the markets. It'll be interesting to see what tomorrow brings. And one little report out before we get into that, I found this interesting. To our north, the Canadian finance minister, and I'm sure I won't pronounce his last name properly, Jim Flaherty. He was involved in the world financial stage. He actually stepped down last month, and he suddenly died. He was age 64. And yes, people 64 do die, but he was heavily involved in balancing Canada's budget after pumping stimulus money into the economy following the 2008 crisis. And I guess he was the longest serving finance minister among the group of seven leading industrial economies until he announced he was stepping down only 3 weeks ago to return to the private sector. So I just thought that was another interesting point. We've seen a lot of lives being lost to various reasons, and just interesting. Since we're on an interesting day, Al.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's all, and it's one of these things where you look around, and I think it's probably always been true that whatever was really going on was not apparent to the vast majority of people. If you go back to merry old England and King Arthur, I'm going to bet that the peasants never really knew what was going on in King Arthur's court. And the same thing is probably true today. But we think that we're entitled to know. We think there are people that are telling us they're going to tell us the truth. And in the end, we still remain in the dark wondering, what the heck are those guys doing? Yeah. Can't say it's good. Can't say it's bad. I can say that it's frustrating, irritating, and annoying. I got one here from CNN Money. Here's a fear and greed index they've cobbled together that they use. And the fear and greed index indicates it runs from 0, which is extreme fear, to 100, which is extreme greed. And it's a mechanism of figuring out what's driving people to invest or divest from the markets. Right now, they are reading it at 30, which is fear. It's probably moderate fear, but it's certainly not in greed. Greed is up at the 100 end. From 50 to 100 is greed. From 0 to 50 is fear. They point out that a year ago, the market was 62, driven by greed. A month ago, it was 73, driven by greed. A week ago, it was neutral, 55. And previous close yesterday was 42, which was fear, but not as much fear as they measure today. Implication, you know, it's a graph. It doesn't prove anything. It's just a way of looking at things. But the implication is that what we're seeing happening in the market today is driven by fear. That's the implication. We'll know better tomorrow when we see what happens in the market. Does the market spring back tomorrow? Regain 200 points? Or does it drop another 200 points? What do you think, Maldi?
I don't know. Big drop today. You would expect it to be a little bit on the upside. But if you have that fear creeping in, everybody is going to cover and protect themselves for the weekend. So they might be selling more prior to the weekend. Mark Faber, he's the editor of the publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom report. He's looking for a 30% crash in the next 12 months. And he says he thinks in the next 12 months an 87 type of a crash, and he thinks it will be even worse than that of 87. And, you know, he's been around a long time, and, you know, he's been spot on, off and on, and he knows what's going on as so. And what's interesting is they're really pulling out the big believers on the financial news programs talking about that conditions for a bad market simply don't exist.
Conditions for a bad market don't exist?
Yes. So that's what the other side is saying. Of course, they're talking about the value in the stocks. But most people with a half a brain understands that the only reason that the stock market came back wasn't true fundamentals of a strong economy, even a rebounding. It was the fundamentals of the Federal Reserve. And personally, what I believe, what I think is also could be happening, as I'm sorry, when they released those March minutes and Yellen had the, I mean, there was just no sign of strength coming from the head of the Federal Reserve, in my view. And I'm wondering if this just isn't a we talk about confidence.
Yeah.
And so I think it has a lot to do with...
I think that fear greed index is to some extent valuable, and it refutes the idea a little bit when you say anyone who has half a brain understands such and such. Well, people who have half a brain are generally in the markets per se. I mean, I understand everybody thinks, well, I'm smart, I can be in the markets.
Would be surprised.
We're there for emotional reasons more so than intelligent reasons. And not all of us. I understand some people are genuinely intelligent, genuinely have the ability to comprehend what's going on. But most people only look at which direction the market is moving. Is it going up? Good. Then pile on. If it's going down, bang, get out. All right? It's not a question of right and wrong. It's not even a question of fundamentals. It's just a question of what direction is the market moving at any given moment. Now, we have a plunge protection team to guarantee that it does not move downward to any significant degree. So that means the market is either going to hold its own or it's going to move up. Unless something strange is going on, and maybe we're getting to the end of this game. I've got an article here from ZeroHedge.com that touches on that idea. The headline is Triple Whammy Shocker, Goldman Shutting Down Sigma X. They explain that Michael Lewis's Flash Boys, a book called Flash Boys, it went up on, it was reported on 60 Minutes 1 week ago, maybe two, hit the markets. A book, it's on high-frequency trading, all right? And as a result, he provoked renewed investigation by the FBI, the SEC, and the Department of Justice into high-finance trading. This is strange, and at the time I saw the book came out at the same time 60 Minutes did an interview, and I wondered, is this set up? Is this a sign that they are going for somebody? They're going to do something finally about controlling whatever's going on was in on Wall Street. A few days later, the shocker became a double whammy. Now, they said, Goldman said they were going to back out of high finance trading and they were going to diminish their relationship with the New York Stock Exchange. Now, I'm reading from an article that doesn't explain what they mean when they say goodbye to the New York Stock Exchange, and I don't know what they mean, all right? The people at ZeroHedge.com, they get it. I don't. All right? I just don't understand the details. I don't. But they're saying Goldman is going to abandon high finance or high frequency trading, which has been very lucrative for them over the past several years. And they're also going to say they're going to diminish or sever whatever relationship exists between them and the New York Stock Exchange. And then there's news coming out that Goldman is going to close its so-called dark pool trading operation known as Sigma X. Now, this is apparently a private stock trading venue. It's one that you and I and the rest of the great unwashed can't get into, but Goldman and special entities can. Well, they're even walking out of that. And the author of the article, again from Zero Hedge, he says, something truly big and transformational is coming. Goldman would not get out of the high-frequency trading. They wouldn't abandon the New York Stock. They wouldn't sever or reduce their relationship with the New York Stock Exchange and also close its dark pool unless something truly big and transformational is coming, something disruptive. He goes on, he says, and he quotes Ron Morgan and Brian Levine, Goldman partners and co-heads of Goldman Global Stock Markets, who said that unless there are some changes, there's going to be a massive crash, a flash crash times 10. Another thing that's certain, take a long, hard look at the market as you know it today, because in less than a year, it will be history. Now, this is the kind of thing that can put people in a state of fear. All right? Clearly, Goldman's in a state of fear. They're giving up what have been lucrative avenues, right? The mechanisms they've had to make money and have influence. And they're saying, I think we're out of here. Why? I think because they understand that they're liable to get caught for criminal. They're liable to expose themselves being tried for criminal offenses if they continue. But they understand that something has happened, and it goes back to that book Flash Crash, and it has had an effect. It's provoked, renewed investigation by the FBI, SEC, the Department of Justice, and into high-frequency trading. Something's going on here. There is going to be some semblance of law and order and effective regulation imposed on Wall Street. And if that happens, it's hard to say what that means. It's not hard to sit back and say, you know, it could mean that they're going to stop manipulating the price of gold. I'm not telling you that's going to happen, but I'm going to tell you that's absolutely a possibility. We will know better. We'll have a better idea of whether we are in a serious decline. All right? Tomorrow. We'll find out tomorrow. Stock market go up. Stock market go down. If the stock market goes down, especially if it goes down 100 points, 200 points, whatever, people are going to sit back and say, uh-oh. On the other hand, if the plunge protection team can pick the stock market back up and push it back up 200-300 points, then people will say, yay, and we'll be back in the area of greed as motivation rather than fear for motivation. So it's too early to say just yet, but this is one of those notions, you know, one of those events you look at it and say, ha ha, is this the big one? What do you think, Melody? Is this the big one, or is this just, you know, another blip?
Oh, you know, it's too hard to say when you have rigged markets, you know, the numbers that we have today, if it wasn't for the Federal Reserve, we wouldn't be here. So to say if this is the big one or not, but the big one is, if this isn't, the big one is coming.
Yeah, I understand.
I mean, it's coming. This is a wake up, people. Do something.
Yeah.
Instead of just sitting back and saying and collecting your quarterly statements like everything is okay and it's going to be here forever. I saw an interview with Carl Icahn. You know, he's one of the elite, and you know, and he's had this ongoing battle with Yahoo, and they were asking him about the markets today. He says, well, you know, everywhere I go, people are talking about the stock market. Oh, you need to buy this, you need to buy that. That's when you get out, and that's exactly what he said. So it's time to get out. People rush in at the last minute, and that's when you get out. They've been buying for the last year, and it's time to get out. So smart people are out, and they might not admit it, but the smart people are out. Smart people are in gold and silver. 5 million silver eagles last month. Those people were smart.
Well, the reason why is because what most people just don't
buy
grasp
low.
Or appreciate.
Buy
low and sell high, I get that. But the danger in all of this is that once we accepted a debt-based monetary system,
yes.
If we cancel the debt, if the debt can't be paid, we wipe out a correlative amount of paper assets. When you had an asset-based monetary system that's based on gold, silver, cattle, whatever, if someone cancels a debt, suppose I borrowed 10 ounces of gold from somebody, and one way or another we default on the debt. I can't pay the 10 ounces of gold back. Well, it's a bad deal for the guy who loaned me the 10 ounces, but the 10 ounces is still there. It's in the economy. I have it. He doesn't have it. I have it, but it's still here available to the community, to the tribe, to the state, to the nation, whatever. The asset survives even though the debt is eliminated. When we have debt-based monetary systems, if the debt is defaulted on, we wipe out the paper assets. A correlative, if we wipe out $17 trillion in national debt, we must also wipe out $17 trillion in national paper assets. And the system can't survive that sort of a loss. Yeah, it's for that reason that you got to get away from that paper. It's going to kill you if you hang on to it. I want to remind folks or let you know that James Corbett was our guest last night on 8 o'clock program. Melody and I hosted, and James will be, we are going to repeat that program over the next 40 minutes in this program. James is in Japan. He has intelligent and insightful comments. Tell us what's happening in Japan, what's likely to happen in the Ukraine situation, and Melody and I will be back mañana. Please stay tuned.
Have a heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival with co-host Melody Cederstrom. Program's brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. And barring the unforeseen, our guest is here. Guest is James Corbett, who has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. And he's also the editor and lead writer of the International Forecaster, Bob Chapman's publication, until a couple of years ago when Bob Chapman passed on. We're going to talk to James about Japan, for one thing, and what he thinks is going to happen relative to the Ukrainian situation, and we'll get his take on a number of things. Hello, James. How are you doing?
Hello, Alfred. Hello, Melody. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hello, James. Thank you for being here.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with why are you in Japan? You've been there for 10 years. Now, that's kind of an odd situation. What got you into Japan?
Well, actually, it was really just my own curiosity, travel wanderlust. I wanted to see some more of the world, and I'd never been over to Asia, so I thought, hey, why not go to Asia? And the easiest way for me to do that, I had some student loans to pay off, so I thought, well, why don't I teach English? So I looked it up online. The first thing that came up was a company here in Japan, so I applied, I got the job, and next thing I knew, I was out here. It was really just a way to travel and see a bit of the world for a year, but that turned into 2 years, that turned into 3 years, and here I am 10 years later with a wife and a child here, and so I've definitely put down some roots.
What about Japanese demographics right now? We've heard reports the Japanese society is aging, that young people are reluctant to have children, they're even closing schools. How much of that is exaggerated? How much of it is true, and what are the long-term implications?
Well, unfortunately, it is very true, and in fact, it's documentable. In fact, last year, in 2013, the Japanese population fell by a record 244,000 people, which out of a population of over 126 million is, I suppose, not that much. But of course, this is just the thin edge of the wedge of the kind of demographic tidal wave that's about to wash over Japan in the coming decades, barring some sort of drastic turnaround. We see an extremely low birth rate here. I believe it's somewhere around the 1.2 or 1.3 children per couple level right now. Of course, well below the population's sustainable population rate. So we are seeing a gradual shrinking that is about to become a very fast shrinking of the population. And in fact, it's expected to cut by as much as 40% by 2060. So we are definitely seeing the beginning of a phenomenon that, in fact, is going to be happening in a lot of countries in the Western world, in the industrialized world, that all have similarly low birth rates. And if it weren't for the high immigration to places like the United States, the population there would be declining as well. Mm-hmm. So, of course, Japan being a quite insular society doesn't allow a lot of immigration, so their population is already starting to shrink.
All right. What do you think the implications are? For example, they're sitting right next to China. If their population is diminishing, it just stands to reason they're less and less able to defend their territory.
That is certainly one of the implications, right? But I think really the key thing about this is the economic implications. And we are going from a society that during its boom years in the post-war years was exploding in population and exploding in economic activity. And so there were a large social safety net that was created here on the back of that economic growth that seemed sustainable at the time, where you had several workers supporting each retiree. And now, of course, we have not only a shrinking population, but also an aging population, as you point out. So we have more and more and more people retiring. In fact, I believe Japan has either just passed or is just about to pass the milestone of selling more adult diapers than children diapers, which is a pretty phenomenal thing to think about. So so we are definitely here in Japan facing this kind of demographic crisis of having very few workers supporting each retiree. I don't know the exact figure, but I believe it's now somewhere between one and two workers supporting each retiree, which is, of course, not sustainable, considering the large pension system that they have here in place. And it's particularly worrying because, of course, the Japanese government is the most indebted of any industrialized nation, now well over 200, I believe approaching 250% of GDP. Mm-hmm. And that is only sustainable because a lot of that debt is internal. The Japanese people have been supporting it by buying Japanese government bonds as part of their retirement packages. But now that more people are retiring, they're going to stop buying those bonds and start cashing them in. And that's going to have a significant effect on Japan's ability to basically sustain its debt levels. So we're starting to see some of the same tricks that the Bank of Japan is pulling, that the Federal Reserve is pulling, which is basically just monetization of the debt.
How much longer? Go ahead, Melody.
What is the inflation over there now?
It's in the doldrums. I don't know the figure off the top of my head, but there's been a complete lack of inflation here for the last two decades since the popping of the bubble. Basically, during the bubble years in the late 80s, early 90s, there was such an inflation of the economy, such a huge expansion of the economy that they're still trying to grow their way out from under that that expansion that took place. So there's been basically no inflation, which is what the whole Abenomics that we were heard so much about last year is supposedly designed to do, is to get inflation going again in the Japanese economy, which is why they're committed to doubling the monetary supply here in the next 2 years, which started a year ago. So I suppose by next year, they're going to attempt to double the monetary supply here.
What can we learn in the United States from Japan's example? Are we on the same track?
A lot of people have suggested as much. I think that there are some differences here because, of course, again, Japan being an island nation that relies on a lot of imports to fuel its economic activity and that relies on exports of technological goods for a lot of its economic activity, it puts it in a slightly different position than the United States and what the issues it's facing. But there are similarities. Certainly, rocketing debt levels is not something that would be foreign to the American audience, nor the types of economic squabbling that goes over here over the budget and how best to deal with this. And I think it's no surprise that Shinzo Abe, the new prime minister here, and the Bank of Japan has arrived at pretty much the same formula as the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank and many central banks around the world now, this idea of quantitative easing and basically just buying their way out of this situation by printing money. And this is all part of the global currency war that's been picking up pace in the last few years and is continuing as basically they're trying to devalue the yen as a way to increase the attractiveness of their exports, which is also shooting themselves in the foot because, of course, they're also importing liquid natural gas and other energy here in order to fuel their economic activity. So it doesn't really help in the end. And I think the Japanese people are only really just starting to realize this. And it's perhaps similar to what's happening in the United States with the gradual realization that the entire growth of the stock market since the Lehman Brothers collapse has been fueled by the Federal Reserve and is basically just paper wealth that will and that can and will disappear as soon as the piper stops playing the tune.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over and let's talk about Fukushima a little bit. I've got an article here from one of the executives or anonymous senior TEPCO employee. No one knows what to do at Fukushima. It's impossible to refix. Reactors not under control. We just can't deal with melted fuel. We hear a lot of stories in this country, in the United States, about how big a problem Fukushima is. Are we getting hyperbole over here, or is it as serious as we've heard, and how do the Japanese respond to it?
Well, I think it's actually a bit of both. I think that depending on which sources you're looking at, there is either hyperbole or underplaying of the situation. There's very few sources out there that are, I think, reporting on a kind of level, in a level way about it. Certainly, it is true that the decommissioning and decontamination of the plant at this point is not only not happening, it's not even theoretically possible at this point. The technology, as members of TEPCO and the Japanese Nuclear Authority here have talked about in the past, the technology to clean up the plant at this point does not exist because they cannot get close enough to the melted cores to even understand, to even map where they're lying or what form they've taken, let alone to start the idea of actually removing that the melted cores. So it is a very worrying situation, specifically, of course, for the Fukushima region. But, of course, that being on the coast, it is also feeding out into the Pacific Ocean, which creates, obviously, huge problems for the fisheries in the region and implications for that radiation reaching the west coast of the United States, given the ocean currents. So there are significant issues there. On the other side of it, there are people who have talked about this being some sort of extinction-level event and that sort of thing. I think that is overplayed, and I there's no hard data to back up what they're talking about in terms of the radiation those types of reports would indicate. But again, it's in Japan, it's an interesting situation because although they do talk about it, they do report about what's happening at the plant here, and it is still in the news, but it is not something that is part of people's daily conversation here, at least not in my part of the country. And I'm 400 miles away from the Fukushima plant and on the west side of the country, which is in many ways kind of infrastructurally separated from the east side where Fukushima Fukushima is, so that the utility grid and everything is not the same grid. So people don't think about it or talk about it on a daily basis here, but it is certainly still part of the societal conversation and something that I think should be concerning for people in Japan, if for no other reason than, of course, they're still taking the debris from the site and burning it at various facilities around Japan, which is really just spreading that radiation around.
I understand. Putting it up in the air and the atmosphere. It's certainly, if you can believe the hype, it's frightening. On the other hand, I've seen reports on what happened at Chernobyl. And they have animals running around there, and they're doing just fine. The radiation is being picked up in their bones and in their bodies, but other than that, they're okay.
So one thing
whether radiation is quite as dangerous as some people suppose.
Well, there have been, for example, there was a study that was published a few years ago that claims as many as 1 million people have died as a result of Chernobyl, which, of course, is quite different than the official figure, which is, I believe, something like a dozen or so people died as a direct result of the radiation from Chernobyl. So quite a discrepancy there. And again, I think that the reality is somewhere in between. I don't think it's as much as a million. I think that those studies are highly questionable, and a lot of people have come out about it. But I think that you're exactly right that the surprise for a lot of people is that wildlife continues in Chernobyl, and that there's kind of regrowing of the area. And a parallel to that would be here in Japan, where I'm quite close to Hiroshima, which, of course, in the minds of pretty much everyone around the world, is exactly equated to the nuclear event in 1945, the end of the Second World War. And so I had that in mind the first time I ever visited Hiroshima, and was surprised to see a thriving, bustling, modern city, and quite an amazing city, a really, really, I think, a vibrant city. And I think that's kind of surprising for people who grew up hearing about it and seeing the pictures in the aftermath and hearing about how it would be irradiated for tens of thousands of years, and there's this bustling, thriving city right on top of it. Mm-hmm. So I think, I think that there are some questions about the way that that radiation is treated in the media, because it is kind of that invisible boogeyman that hits on a lot of people's nightmare fantasies. At the same time, I think that there are causes for concern, and we do have to keep our eye, for example, on the thyroid cancer rates in the Fukushima region, especially among the young people who, of course, are most affected by that.
We've got about 2 minutes before, maybe three minutes before we take our next break. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what's happening in the Senkaku Islands?
The Senkaku Islands, yes.
Japan and China over five islands, if I understand correctly.
That's right. These are a small island chain in the East China Sea that are uninhabited, and up until very recently were not really controversial. They were assumed to be under Japanese control, but China in the late 1970s, I believe, started putting forward the idea that, well, traditionally and historically, these are Chinese islands, and they've been sort of in certainly in the last couple of years more forcefully asserting that right. And really the question is why this island chain in particular, because it is an uninhabited island chain and doesn't really have any strategic importance, except for the fact that it was, I believe, in the late 1960s that a UN geological survey showed that there were oil and gas deposits in the area right around those islands. So I think we're seeing this as sort of an extension of the resource wars that are shaping up between China and various powers around the globe, as the gaping maw of the Chinese economy continues swallowing more and more resources around the world. I think that's why it's becoming a flashpoint. And so we've seen a lot of very worrying games of brinkmanship around those islands in recent months, including several incidents where Japanese fighter jets were scrambled in response to intrusions on the airspace or by ships in the area around these islands, etc. And we haven't heard much about it in the last several weeks, but I think it's still a point of tension that's continuing to rise between China and Japan, which is really just one of many tensions that's popped up in recent months and is only being fed, I think, because it really does play into the political agenda of both the prime minister here in Japan and the new president there in China.
We've got probably 60 seconds before we take our break. To what extent do you suppose that the rising tensions between China and Japan is based in part by the United States pulling in its horns and becoming less of the global policeman than it's been since World War II?
To be honest, I think it's the exact opposite. We saw about maybe three years ago now, the Pentagon specifically said they wanted to start the Asia-Pacific pivot, which is to withdraw some of their forces and resources from the Middle East, where they've been obviously occupied for the last decade and a half, and putting that towards Asia. And we've been seeing that in numerous different ways, the start of a new marine base in Darwin, Australia, and the deployment of more naval assets here. We've seen military contracts with the usual defense contractors in the United States increasing for the various U.S. allies in the region, South Korea, the Philippines, Japan. So I think it's the exact opposite. We're seeing more of a turn by the U.S. towards the Asia-Pacific region that I think is feeding into the conflict itself.
Okay, we're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom and James Corbett. We'll be back in a moment on Financial Survival.
For their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom and our guest, James Corbett. James is calling us from Japan and offering us some insight on the ground where we can find out a little bit more about what's really happening in Japan and perhaps get away from the hype and get away from the understatement and hopefully get an objective assessment of what's been happening in Japan. We're going to also talk about the Russian-Ukraine problem and how that may affect the petrodollar and so on. That'll be our next subject. But Melody, did you want to say something?
Yeah, if there's any listeners out there that would like to ask James a question, if you can keep your question brief, call us at 1-800-596-8191. That's 1-800-596-8191.
Okay, James, we have a problem in the Ukraine that is, I don't know, it, does it strike you as all rational? And is it going to boil out of control, or tempest in a teapot, and this will be all under control in the next little while? How do you see this in the Ukraine?
Well, I see this as a significant geopolitical event that's taking place right now, and I think it will have consequences one way or another that I think will start to come clear in the coming weeks. And to a certain extent, I'm not expecting this to boil over into a heated military confrontation, but at any rate, it is sort of setting the battle lines, I think, for what is being dubbed as the new Cold War. And as much as I might have problems with that frame, at any rate, it is being framed that way, and thus I think it will become kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And we're starting to see that happening culturally in the Western countries with. Was something that I saw online the other day, which again seems trivial and kind of silly, but I think it is very telling. I saw an ad for a taco chain in New York City that was advertising, "Putin cannot eat here; he's barred from this restaurant until he gives up on the Ukraine," or something. Which again is just silly, and of course just a silly advertising type of thing. But I think is reflective of the way the conversation has really drastically changed in the last year or two. You had Romney on the campaign trail in 2012 talking about Russia as the greatest geopolitical threat to the United States. And at the time, the remark was widely poo-pooed and even seen as kind of being a bit rash and detrimental. But now I think most people would probably agree with that. So there's been a remarkable transformation that's taken place. And I think it's on the back of a lot of hypocrisy that's going on in that region now. I don't think that either side in this conflict is really an angel and is really out for anything other than their own political and geopolitical gain. But I think this has to be seen as the end point of a series of really quite bold moves that NATO has been making in recent years to continue the encirclement of Russia. And we see that happening militarily with things like the ballistic missile defense shield. We just saw a new U.S. advanced destroyer arrive in Spain as part of this shield back in February, which is ostensibly against to counter the threat of some theoretical potential future Iranian nuclear weapon. But of course, is really, I think everyone understands, is really aimed at Russia and its ability to really launch or defend itself against a nuclear strike. And I think it's important to understand that in the last several years, the U.S. has not only failed to dismiss the idea, but has actually encoded into their military terminology and their battle plans the idea of a first strike nuclear use of tactical nuclear weapons, which is, again, pretty unthinkable at this point in terms of where we are geopolitically. But the fact that that still remains on the table and that's still justifying the vast nuclear arsenal of the U.S. and, of course, of Russia is, I think, pretty worrying and something that we have to keep our eye on as it continues to develop.
We've watched Russia. Well, first off, it appears that you've at least implied that the precipitant for the problem we're seeing in Russia right now in the Ukraine and Crimea confrontation started with NATO trying to move in and surround Russia. Russia is, from that perspective, Russia may not be the innocent victim in this, but Russia is not necessarily the villain either, is it?
No, I think that would be all entirely too simplistic to paint Russia as the villain any more than I think Putin is some sort of hero. I'm certainly not implying that either. But certainly I think that the aggressor in this incident would be the NATO powers and the European Commission, which with its basically this all started, for people who don't know, back last year as the Ukraine really started to experience some very, very significant debt problems that made it to the point where Ukraine was having problem financing its debt and really did require outside assistance one way or another. They were seeking perhaps a deal with the European Commission, but even as far as deals with the European Commission go, the one that they were proposing was particularly weak. It basically came with all sorts of strings attached to that and did not even offer kind of basic goodies for the Ukrainian people, like freedom of movement within the EU or freedom to work in the EU or anything of that sort. So basically at that point, Yanukovych turned to Russia, which was offering some incentives and has been offering incentives for quite a while in terms of gas discounts and the like. And that's obviously set off these protests. But these protests have to be seen in the light of what Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland admitted several months ago is the endpoint of a $5 billion campaign that the U.S. State Department has been involved in the last several years, funding democratic groups and democratic democracy-building institutions in the Ukraine. So this is not just some sort of spontaneous thing that happened all of a sudden. This is the endpoint of a very calculated, I think, a long-term agenda that's been at work in the Eastern European countries generally and in Ukraine specifically. And I think we'd be naive to think otherwise. So, yes, attempts to portray Putin as some sort of ultra-villain in all of this, I think, is as naive as believing that he's some sort of innocent angel in all of this either.
Okay. Is Russia in danger? I mean, great peril. Are people seriously thinking about initiating a nuclear strike on Russia and wiping the country out?
I don't believe that's an imminent possibility, but it does in all of these types of conflicts. I think that these conflicts generally tend to be very, very much manipulated and are often, if not staged, at least often are more bluster and bravado than they are reality. But having said that, there's always the possibility that these types of conflicts will eventually spill over into actual confrontation, if only by miscalculation or someone with an itchy trigger finger starting something that can't be stopped. And it is quite worrying that here we sit 100 years after the start of World War One with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was a pretty random thing, seemingly, to start a global conflict like what World War One became. And I think we've all probably heard about the reasons for the interlocking alliances that basically started this sort of mechanism of war that couldn't be stopped. And we do sit at a similar precipice today, and it doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to happen. But again, all it would take is some sort of fairly random event like the assassination of some leader or something like that, and who knows how it will result. So I think it is certainly a time of increased tension, and the threat that is faced by the Russian people, I think, is an existential threat insofar as NATO really does not show signs that they're going to back down from this, and in fact is showing every sign that they're going to step up the pressure. Anders Fogh Rasmussen, now the Secretary General of NATO, now calling for increased NATO budget in the wake of this crisis. Obviously, this justifies an increase in the NATO members' contributions to NATO itself. And now we see Ukraine, the newly imposed Ukrainian coup government, now openly conducting joint military exercises with NATO. So there's definitely something that's going on here that is ratcheting up tensions to a point that we haven't seen since the end of the Cold War. So, again, it's a very dangerous situation, and there's no easy way out. And unfortunately, once again, it's the Ukrainian people who are really squeezed in this pincher movement and who suffer as a result of it. And just not only, I mean, all the chaos and violence and bloodshed that's happening there, but also just economically speaking, we see the newly installed Ukraine government under Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, one of the first things they did was come out to say they're willing to cooperate with the IMF and agree to any terms that the IMF wants. And under the new IMF aid package, which is going to amount to somewhere in the neighborhood of $16 billion, there's, again, all sorts of austerity strings that are being attached to this, which is particularly head-scratching because just a couple of months ago, the IMF said, well, you know what? We were wrong about austerity. It actually increases income inequality. It's actually a failed policy. They were advocating against the Australian government from implementing austerity measures, and now they're attaching them to the Ukrainian aid package. So, again, it's the Ukrainian people who are going to suffer for all of this.
What's going to happen to the price of gold? Is it likely to jump significantly? Is it going to stay where it is? Some people predict it's going to fall. What do you see the global economy is doing to the price of gold, and in what time frame?
Well, it absolutely should be rising. Just on the basis of gold as the go-to investment in times of destabilization. So just as the flight to safety trade alone, we should be seeing a spike in gold. And we have seen a little bit, certainly as tensions are beginning to increase there and they're entering into talks now in Ukraine. We have seen gold edging back up above 1300, now sitting somewhere around 1315 as we're talking. So we're definitely seeing sort of a rising trend of gold, but the question is how much and how soon or how long, and how long will that last? Again, that's unfortunately not something that's up to natural market forces to decide, because one of the fallouts from the recent reporting on high frequency trading that's gotten a lot of talk in recent weeks, including the big 60 Minutes special and the new book that's coming out on the subject. One of the things that people aren't talking about with regards to high frequency trading is not just manipulation of the stock market, but manipulation of gold and silver prices. And there was an interesting article that appeared on Zero Hedge the other day by way of Smart Knowledge EU, which talked specifically about this phenomenon and how high frequency trading is used to attack the ETFs and the gold market in general. And was talking about some very specific instances that you could cite. For example, February 29th, 2012, the GLD dropped 1% in less than one third of a second. Mm-hmm. The ETF symbol SLV exceeding 75,000 trades per second for 25 milliseconds. Again, these are the types of fingerprints of the high frequency trading robot algorithms that are increasingly dominating the markets. And as a result of this type of manipulation, again, we can't really rely on the dollar denomination of gold as any sort of indicator of gold value in this economy. It is just another indication of the manipulation. So I think that the real question is, when will the manipulation, if not end, at least stop being so effective? And I think that there is a point at which that will be reached. I don't think we're there yet. So it's certainly conceivable that by the end of the year, gold will be down on the year. But I certainly do see that in the coming years, as the dollar continues to be eroded by all of the various geopolitical forces going on right now, gold denominated in dollars will definitely start to spike.
Is there any difference? Is there a premium being paid on gold in Japan, for example, as compared to the price that we find out of the New York markets? Do they pay more in Japan?
They do in several senses. I mean, of course, there's the exchange issue. And so in the last year or two, we've seen definitely a drop in the value of the yen on as compared to the dollar, for example. So I here buying gold here in Japan have seen a relative rise in the value in the price of gold. We've also seen, for example, just in the last couple of weeks, Japan just hiked its consumption tax from 5% to 8%. So we saw a spike in buying ahead of that rise in taxes of people basically trying to get in. And in fact, some investors or speculators just basically trying to make advantage of that 3% spread. So they were trying to get in and buy it and then sell it afterwards. So that we saw some gold dealers taking advantage of that and raising their prices as well. But of course, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners probably know, in East Asia generally, there's been a gold buying frenzy in recent years, especially in China, where it's really taking off. So I think that there's a bit of a premium paid because people are willing to pay more for physical gold here in East Asia, simply because I think that they are well aware of the problems with the current petrodollar regime, and the writing is on the wall. And I think it's being read by a lot of people, except, of course, for the talking heads on the mainstream news who are trying to basically lulled the American public into thinking that China is buying gold at a furious pace. But don't worry, I'm sure it's just a fad and there's nothing behind it, which is generally
it's
what
kind of like a hula hoop. It'll be all over in a little while. We'll get past it.
Doesn't do anything.
We have about 45 seconds left. Why don't you give us some information on where folks can find the Corbett Report and whatever else you'd like to point them to, your blog, website, whatever.
That's right. I'm at CorbettReport.com. That's CORBETT report.com. And that has links to all of the other things that I do, including, of course, as you mentioned at the top, the International Forecaster. I write the lead editorial there twice a week. So people should definitely check that out. Again, it's Bob Chapman's old publication and is still continuing twice a week, 30 to 40 pages every week. So I think it's every few days on Wednesdays and Saturdays. So definitely a valuable resource for people to be checking out. So they can check that out directly at theinternationalforecaster.com.
All right, thecorbettreport.com. I want to thank you for being on the program, Jim. We're out of time. Melody, thank you.
Thank you, James. I appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks to maybe the producer. Want to thank all of you people for listening. We'll be back, Melody and I will be back tomorrow morning. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, James, and Frank, the producer.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.